This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also download over at our website at progressive.org. Today, my guest is Bill Fletcher. He's one of the best activists and thinkers we have in this country. He's co-founder of the Center for Labor Renewal. He's the executive editor of blackcommentator.com. He's the past education director at the AFL-CIO, former head of Trans Africa. He's got a new book out that he co-wrote called Solidarity Divided: The Crisis in Organized Labor, and a New Path Toward Social Justice. Bill Fletcher, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Matt, it's great to be here.
Where do you want to start? Should we start with your book?
Let's start with the book.
Yeah. What motivated you to write this book?
Several things. What I like to say is that the very first page where I discuss this visit I took to South Africa with the leadership of SEIU, Service Employees International Union, back in June 2001. In that visit, there was an exchange that really, it was at that point that the book really started being written, at least in my head. And then I'll get back to that. The second thing that influenced it was the split in the AFL-CIO.
Well, let's go to South Africa. What was said there that made such an impression?
We had this exchange between SEIU and their sister union in South Africa, the National Education, Health, and Allied Workers Union. And we on that particular day, we were talking about politics. And this SEIU, young SEIU progressive leader said, the role of the union is to represent its members. And the South Africans paused, and then they said, not so fast, comrades. The role of the union is to represent the working class. And there are times when the interests of our unions are actually in conflict with the interests of the workers, working class. And Matt, it was really amazing. It was like a Twilight Zone moment. It's like everything stopped. Everything. There was no talking, nothing. Then it started again. But none of the people from the U.S. responded to the South Africans. The South Africans, being very cordial, didn't push the point, and we just continued.
But it's an old point. I mean, I remember the machinist socialist union leader William Wippesinger was talking about, you know, getting rid of armaments, which would gotten rid of a lot of his employees.
That's right.
A lot of the workers he was representing. So, I mean, it shouldn't have been new or dawning on that young activist at SEIU, but that just shows, I suppose, what you're saying is it shows the diminishment in the ideology of the labor union leaders.
It does, and it also showed what we call in the book the ideologizing of organizing. In other words, where you have a union like SEIU that's been growing and organizing, and people automatically assume that that means that the union is cutting edge, that the union is progressive, that it's visionary. And it doesn't necessarily mean that at all. I mean, it means that it's growing. It means that it's doing some things right. It means it's also doing some things wrong. But what was happening in South Africa was precisely what you said. There was this ideological challenge, and the people from the U.S. didn't really know how to respond to it. The second thing that happened was a few years later, in the circumstances that led up to the split in the AFL-CIO, Fernando Agapacin, my co-author, and I, along with a lot of other people, felt, what is going on here?
I mean, that's what I felt. I was looking at that from the outside, and I just didn't understand it.
There was no there. And as much as the people that went on to form Change to Win would say that there were fundamental disagreements, we couldn't identify them. And it was at that point that we literally started to write the book. We were approached by a publisher who ended up not being our fundamental publisher, but we were approached by a publisher who said, you need to write a book. And I said, okay, this is the book we want to write.
Now, Change to Win is this organization that was founded by SEIU and a group of other unions that broke off from the AFL under the leadership of Andy Stern, who is head of the SEIU.
That's right.
To me, looking from the outside again, and you were for a while there in the AFL-CIO, you were not only education director, you were an advisor to John Sweeney, who was head of the AFL. To me, it looked like a personality dispute. It
right.
looked like an ego trip on the part of Andy Stern, and maybe it looked like maybe Sweeney should have stepped down to save the Federation. But that was just my distant observation.
I would agree with much of that. I would say that there was fundamentally, there was frustration that had been brewing for a while among many of the unions in the AFL-CIO. It was frustration because of defeat. You know, there were various changes that had been introduced in the AFL-CIO and in some other unions, but there wasn't significant growth. So there was this frustration that was boiling up. There was also a problem that, how can I put it, that was spoke to Sweeney's leadership style, that there was not an open discussion among the affiliates about what are we trying to do here and why is this not working. These discussions always tended to be more back room. So the frustration was brewing. Then you add to that precisely what you said, personalities, egos, finances, and it all came together. And instead of an open discussion about strategy, you had an exchange based on sound bites and completely erroneous. You know, this whole idea that change to win was in favor of organizing and AFL-CIO was in favor of politics, it was so completely absurd and almost everyone realized it. But this whole thing just gained a certain level of momentum and it was impossible to pull these guys, you know, back.
Where do we stand now with this? I understand there's conversations going on between Change to Win and the AFL-CIO about joining back together.
Right. Well, I think that basically what's happened is that the split failed, and there is a growing recognition and admission that it failed. That the objectives that had been stated in 2005 have not come to fruition. So there are these discussions, but here's the problem, and it may sound somewhat odd, that when the split happened, there were four unions that appealed to both sides to have an open debate. The American Federation of Government Employees, the American Postal Workers Union, Communication Workers of America, and International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. Those four unions said, let's step back from the precipice and let's have a very broad debate. We capture that in the Appendix A of our book. That debate did not take place. Now what's happening is that there's a discussion about a reunification, but there's still no debate. There's still no discussion about what's happened, what succeeded, what failed. There's no discussion about the current economic crisis. There's no discussion about how we should do politics differently. It becomes almost akin to the discussions in the Vatican when a new pope is chosen.
I'm speaking with Bill Fletcher. He's the co-founder of the Center for Labor Renewal and the co-author of a book just out called Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Toward Social Justice. He also, by the way, is executive editor of blackcommentator.com. What are some of those new paths toward social justice for the labor movement that you are getting to in this book?
Well, one thing very fundamentally is that we think that there needs to be a different approach to unionism. That the part of the problem that we have faced metaphorically is the problem of the tire that has a slow leak. So you come out to your car every morning and you put more air in the tire and you drive around all day and everything's fine. The problem is the next morning you still have that slow leak. We think that a different kind of unionism needs to come into play. We call it social justice unionism. And part of what we're trying to say is that you have among workers a variety of different organizations. Unions are only one. But you have the rise over the last 15 or so years, worker centers, which are often it's often called a social wage movement. You have these organizations in communities that are focused on workers, but not necessarily workers and their workplace issues. could be immigration issues. It could be housing. It could be any issues related to poverty. So one thing we have to do is fuse these two movements. And that organized labor has a great deal to learn from this worker-centered movement, which is focused on poorer sections of the working class. A second thing is that we've got to be thinking about building local power. You know, for example, the Change to Win Federation talks a lot about bargaining power. And that's all true. There's no question about that. But even though it often feels like a worker lives in their workplace, they actually don't. And they live in communities. They are dealing with education, healthcare, things like that. And workers have views about these things. And we're seeing it now in this crisis where people are saying, we want an economic approach that's appealing to Main Street, that we're less concerned about Wall Street. The union movement needs to be thinking about that, and it needs to be out in the streets. It needs to be out in the streets protesting when there are home foreclosures. It needs to be demanding that economic assistance is going to average people. But more than that, there needs to be a working people's agenda. And so part of what we recommend in the book is the idea of working people's assemblies. Borrows from ideas that have been practiced, including in this country, over the last century or more, where you actually engage working class organizations in talking about what are, for example, the 10 points in our cities, the 10 points of an agenda in our cities. And so we're talking about a different approach to unionism, talking about building alliances that have generally been tactical at best.
You mentioned the economic crisis we're in. What is your proposal, or what would be a decent solution to this economic crisis?
Well, if I knew the decent solution, I'd be a millionaire. But I would say this, that we should not read very much into what Wall Street is doing when they respond to President Obama's proposals, because most of President Obama's proposals are actually focused on the people that are listening to this program, regular working people. And the Wall Street crew is not particularly concerned about regular working people. So when what we should be thinking about is that there do need to be nationalizations. We have quasi-nationalizations. People just want to play this word game.
It's nuts. You know, we just came out in our editorial at the Progressive Magazine for nationalizing the banks.
That's
and
right.
Having the government run the banks instead of just, you know, appointing the same old management that's run them into the ground.
Absolutely.
And not give them right back to the private
that's
sector,
right.
Which is the other solution that the mainstream's talking about.
That's right. Absolutely. Nationalizing, and I would go further. We need to nationalize the auto industry. We can get into that in a second. But nationalization by itself is not sufficient, because what will happen is actually what you just said. Something will be nationalized temporarily, then it'll be handed back to the private sector when it's when the basic toxic debts have been dealt with. We need to have real public oversight. One of the things that I started raising a few months ago was about nationalizing the auto industry. And what's funny about this, Matt, is that had I raised that a year ago, people would have said, this guy is out of his mind. The response when I've raised it now, even when people disagree, is to treat the proposal as a reasonable proposal that they may or may not agree with. I think that we need to be nationalizing the auto industry. We could start by these plants that have been closed down. The government should buy them and retool them. The basic model, World War II. We need to be thinking about producing different things with all of these means of production that are out there. I mean, we have these factories. We have skilled workers. Why aren't we building windmills? You know, why aren't we building new transportation systems? And if the private sector won't invest, then it seems to me it's up to the government to do this.
It has been a capitulation by the private sector in banking and in autos.
That's right. It's called economic conversion. As you may know, I used to work in a shipyard, and I was a welder. And when the shipyard closed, or was on the verge of closing, there was a movement that developed inside among the workers for economic conversion. We could not convince the union leadership that it was the right path, and certainly couldn't convince
them. When was this, Bill Fletcher?
In the early 1980s.
And were you there to do organizing?
I was there to do organizing. I graduated from college in 76, and less than a year later, got a job as a welder in a shipyard. My father went nuts. He said, well, I sent you to Harvard to become a welder in a shipyard? I said, you sent me to Harvard to increase my education. And I did. And I decided I needed to get involved in the labor movement. And I wanted to get involved from the bottom up. So I went to work as a welder. And I always considered that a part two of my education.
What was the union you were with?
The Industrial Union of Marine and Shipbuilding Workers of America.
And how long did you stay doing that kind
of work? I was there in that particular job for about 3.5 years. And I was almost killed on the job. I fell 20 feet, actually landed on my head. Oof. And people said I was hard-headed. I guess I proved it. But it was an industrial accident.
Were you hospitalized?
Actually, overnight. I was very lucky. The only reason I'm alive talking to you today is that I was knocked unconscious on the way down. So I felt like a rag doll. But had I been awake, I would have died.
How were you knocked unconscious on the way down? Did you hit something?
I did. I hit a metal stiffener. What happened, I was welding. I just come back from a break. And I went to start welding, and I was on a wood board, plank. The plank was not tied down. See, when you're in shipbuilding, but this is also true in the building trades, it is so dangerous that if you think about the dangers, you'll be paralyzed, which often means that the workers will take certain things for granted. That's what I did. I went to the top of this area, this compartment I was working in, and I went to weld. And the last thing I remember, I was losing my balance. The next thing I remember, my eyes opened, and I was looking around, and I was feeling pain. And my partner was sitting way above me, looking down at me. And I couldn't figure out why I was there. And I had fallen. So I fell back, hit this metal, was knocked unconscious, dropped, and survived.
You didn't break your neck. That's a miracle.
It is a miracle. Only had a mild concussion.
And then you had a real awareness of the problems of occupational hazards.
Absolutely. And also what's interesting is that we on the political left were mainly responsible for building the occupational health and safety movement of the 1970s. You know, before that, issues of occupational health and safety were not treated seriously, and those that raised it were often baited. You know, you would be called a punk, sometimes a faggot, for being concerned about occupational health and safety. I'm not exaggerating.
Right, you weren't tough enough to deal with
it. You weren't tough enough.
That was a macho thing.
Right. And what happened was that many members of the political left that were in workplaces began raising issues. And that's when you had the COSH movement, these committees on occupational safety and health, that started to appear around the country. And in the shipyard, it was the second most dangerous industry in the country at the time after mining.
Thousands of people die every year from workplace hazards.
All the time. And it's just simply taken for granted. But we raised awareness. One of the things that we learned from that is that it's important to have solutions when you're identifying the problems. And that's a lesson that I've carried with me ever since.
What are the solutions to occupational hazards?
Well, it depends on the nature of the problem. So, for example, if you're welding, one of the things that you need are very appropriate facial masks that take into account, with men at least, facial hair, and that really do create they completely cover your face so that the fumes are not getting in. You need, when you're welding, proper ventilation, particularly in the summer, around heat. I mean, they're very basic things. And then there are some materials that simply should not be used. And that's the sort of awareness that we raised. And we started moving this as issues that the union needed to fight for.
And I know Tony Mazzocchi was a big prime mover.
Tony was an incredible person around these and such a tremendous loss for us, many of us personally, but also for the movement politically.
Yeah, he was a real visionary with the oil, chemical, and atomic workers.
Absolutely.
And one of the founders of the Labor Party.
That's right.
So why don't we move on to politics more generally than Bill Fletcher, you are with blackcommentator.com. During the campaign, you were a critical supporter of Barack Obama. Why did you think it was important to support Obama?
Well, I was initially inclined towards Edwards. And the reason I was inclined towards him was that Edwards began his campaign in New Orleans, and he was talking about issues of poverty and class, and he was unfortunately not talking about race, which is something that I was very critical of him for.
And he did the time before, which is
That's
weird.
Right. Exactly. But I thought that he was onto something. But his campaign, he didn't build the kind of rainbow candidacy that he really needed to build, particularly knowing that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were entering it. He needed to do something different. When he dropped out, I felt that Obama's campaign was the right one to back, and for a few reasons. One was that he was an anti-war candidate. And the second was that he was galvanizing millions of people, particularly younger people. And I thought that what we have to recognize is that even when you don't necessarily agree with someone, you look at what's going on with their base and try to figure out what does this mean over the longer term. And it seemed to me what it meant was the possibility of a demand for a new politics. So I became excited by that, but I was critical of him and remain so. I was not, I did not agree with him on his approach to the Israel-Palestine conflict. I thought that he was, when it came to Iran, on the one hand, was not a jingoist promoting war, but at the same time capitulated on this whole notion that Iran represented a threat. But it seemed to me that there was at least some maneuvering room. And since becoming president, I think that, or since the election and then becoming president, I think that it's true. I mean, what's interesting is during the Republic Windows struggle in Chicago, when the workers occupied a factory, what amazed me was when he said that the workers were right. I fell off my chair. I said, when has a president of the United States ever said that?
It was an FDR kind of moment.
That's right. And then when he subsequently said a few weeks ago that unions are not the problem, they're part of the solution, that was an FDR moment. So I feel that there are important things that he's pushing that it's important for progressives and leftists to endorse.
By the same token, Bill Fletcher, he's such a mixed bag, especially when you look at his economic advisors.
Yes.
You got Lawrence Summers up there,
right,
and Tim Geithner, these people who were responsible for the financial mess, especially Summers,
right,
and Geithner, who engineered the bank bailout the first time around and is on record as saying, we've got a private system, it's our job to keep it that way, and
That's right,
seems to be doing everything possible to accomplish that. It would have been better. I remember talking with Naomi Klein or hearing her speak, and she said, as you did earlier in this interview, that we should not look at the Dow Jones average is the indicator of how successful an economic program is. Otherwise, we're hostage to Wall Street.
That's
and
right.
They were always going to say, the market's going to drop 2,000 points if you put a populist economist like Joseph Stiglitz in there,
mm-hmm,
as Secretary of the Treasury. But the market did drop to 7,000 anyway.
That's
you
right.
Might as well have put Joseph Stiglitz
right.
in there. Why do you think he was so timid on it, these macroeconomic issues?
Well, I have not been impressed with his cabinet appointments at all, with the exception of Hilda Solis. And I think that what he's attempted to do is essentially to create a center-right cabinet. And I think that he's done that in order to assure Wall Street that he's not a wild-eyed radical. And I think that that was a major mistake. I do think that a Krugman or a Stiglitz should have been the Treasury Secretary. I think that the idea when he originally appointed the senator from New Hampshire,
Greg,
right, as the Treasury, as the Commerce Secretary, I thought that that was as wrong as the day is long. This idea of raising to a principle, this notion of bipartisanship, I think is wrong.
Yeah, he's got a fetish on bipartisanship.
He absolutely does. And while I absolutely believe that he doesn't have to personalize his opposition to the Republicans, he has to understand what the Republican game plan is. They are out to sabotage everything that he does. They are not interested in bipartisanship. And so he needs to be relying more on regular people. He needs to be relying on labor and on community-based organizations to mobilize. And he needs to encourage that. So I think that his approach has been wrong on this. I disagree. But I would say this, Matt, that particularly in organized labor, and I'm still in organized labor, the problem is that we wait for signals. And so when, for example, when Bush put out his three-page proposal in the midst of the crisis, the New York City Central Labor Council was, I believe, the only one to mobilize against it. There were emails sent out. There were statements by other union federations and councils. But in terms of mobilization, it was them. We should have all been out in the streets.
This was Paulson gets to be economic czar and
right.
The laws are off the books. Basically.
Exactly. It was absolutely absurd. And I think that we in labor need to be out in the streets.
You mentioned Hilda Solis. Tell me about her.
What's interesting about Solis, Congresswoman Solis, is that she is unafraid to identify with unions and to make it clear that her job is to promote unions. Now, this is interesting because when you look back in the Clinton administration, neither of his labor secretaries, neither of them, took such a stance. At best, you could say they were promoting general worker interests at a very vague level. But they didn't want to talk about unions. Solis wants to talk about unions, and I think that that's marvelous. And I think precisely for that reason, her nomination has been held up by the Republicans. I don't think it has anything to do with her husband and whether there's a lien against her husband for $6,000.
Yeah, that's minor. That's meaningless.
Yeah.
Bill Fletcher, we have about a minute left, and I just wonder, what do you think the strategy for the broader progressive movement should be here vis-a-vis Obama?
I think that we need to pressure him from his left. And to pressure him, that means that we have to develop an organizational capability we don't have now. We need a new form of electoral politics, what I call neo-rainbow electoral politics, that actually can pressure him. Because if he doesn't have that pressure, mark my word, he will cave.
And that pressure should come in the streets and in communications.
In the streets, in communications, as well as running our own candidates. We need to have neo-rainbow elected officials who are pressuring him so that it's clear that there's a constituency out there he has to pay attention to.
Bill Fletcher has been my guest today. Bill Fletcher is executive editor of blackcommentator.com. He's also the former head of TransAfrica and the co-founder of the Center for Labor Renewal. You can find that at centerforlaborrenewal.org.
.org.
Bill Fletcher, thanks so much for being my guest.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella, an engineer at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.